evening, everyone.
Good evening.
When I was a little girl, my father used to take me to an old-fashioned hardware store. It had sawdust all over the floor and all these mysterious things hanging on the wall. And there was an old gentleman behind the counter who always, on a day like this, would look at us real hard and say, "Hot enough for you?" Well, sure. So you all are brave, brave souls to be here. I have the book. I hear that you all have been chastised by a faraway student. And I must say that it's misplaced because I'm the one who said yes to it. I'm the one who encouraged Leslie to do the deed. And she's absolutely correct that it's against the rules to copy something that has copyright. And this definitely does. I just read it this afternoon. It's all rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form by any means, electronic, mechanical, photocopying, recording, or otherwise, without the prior permission of the publisher. So we did a bad thing. As Jane said, we broke a precept, or I did, by accepting a suggestion that was not according to the precepts. But I will point out to Jane that one of the other precepts is no praise or blame. So I think we can all take on this without too much angst and carry on. And if we need to, we can apologize to Dalai Lama, though I think he wouldn't mind a bit. So we talked a little bit about it last week, mostly about the introduction, about how sweet he's being to other religions and how open-minded he is about the Buddhist teachings. And then what we're getting here is the Mahayana Vajrayana / Vajrayana view of Madhyamaka's Buddhism, which was a school of Buddhism that grew up in India long, long, long ago. Nagarjuna has a great deal to do with it, a very great, incredible teacher who, they say, dived into the river to retrieve the Heart Sutra and many other things that had not been brought to the world before. So there's a sort of magical understanding about it, but it just means it's really, really important kind of understanding. So he says that he creates two principles, two basic principles, but he has a different way of talking about it a bit, which I like very much. He says, one of them is the interdependent nature of reality, what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. That if whatever you pick up, and this has been said through history by every philosopher who ever started to think about things, if you pick up anything, it's connected to everything else. It just is. This is connected to me, and I'm connected to this, and it's connected to that, and that's blah, 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 infinite number of ways that we are connected, which makes life very interesting and more than we can really understand. So that's his very first basic point. And that was Buddha's basic point as well, that all things are connected. We all belong to each other. And we belong to the trees and the stars, the little dog on the street. It's all part of us. It's part of our life. The other one is what he calls nonviolence, which is an interesting way of talking about compassion. It's about how to be with others, too, about non-harming, we say sometimes, that we vow not to harm anything if we can help it. And of course, you can think of all the various ways that we do harm things anyway. The Jain school of Buddhism carries a little broom, all the monks, and they sweep the sidewalk in front of them so they won't step on any little bug. But of course, they are anyway that they can't see. I always point out that if we wipe our brow, there is a whole village living in every eyebrow. There are people in there. There are actually people all over us and inside us. We know this now. So we're not separate at all. We're a part of the whole thing. So he says we do our best to help others and refrain from harming them as very best as we can. And of course we do. We do harm, and often we're very sorry. And sometimes if we're not very well cultivated, we're not sorry. We become very unpleasant people. So this is about learning to cultivate the best side of ourselves, which is our Buddha side. This is Buddha's teaching. So interbeing, sometimes in Zen we talk about wisdom and compassion. So interbeing is the wisdom side, and compassion is the nonviolent side. That we're willing to care for others. Already, it's a very beautiful teaching. So he says, technically, we become a Buddhist when we decide to take refuge in the three jewels, and when we generate bodhicitta, which is known as compassion. So already we begin with compassion and with refuge. The three jewels are Buddha, Dharma, the truth, the teaching, the law, and Sangha is the community. So it's all one thing, really. You can't have the truth without being in community. Without knowing you're in community. You can't be in community without being aware of the truth of things, because we're teaching and learning from each other all the time. And the Buddha nature itself is the spirituality that we develop. It's our work. Our spirituality is our work. It's not some big, glorious, fancy thing. In fact, it's real hard work. But it's something that's in our nature to want and to feel pulled by. in a way that nothing else does. So taking refuge, he says, lays the foundation to the practitioner to lead his or her life in an ethically disciplined way, i.e., try to be as good as you can, or follow the precepts, no killing, no stealing, no lying, etc. And as we all know, it's very impossible to be perfect about that. We know that. We can't be perfect about it. It just doesn't work. But the more we notice what we're doing, the more aware we are. We say we break the precepts, but it just means that we see, oh, look what I did all over again. Oh, I'm going to try really hard not to do that again. So, sometimes people think this practice is about working really, really hard and getting more and more perfect. And it's always a big disappointment, because when we sit, we already see how utterly imperfect we are. And if we're honest, we have to see that we will always be sort of like this. We're always going to be kind of, I don't know, dorky and mistaken inside in a lot of different ways. We just can't help it. We're just human beings. We're these funny animals with a brain. So taking refuge means you entrust your whole being, your spiritual well-being, in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. We always talk about trust and confidence. And as we know, we can't really trust hardly anything, because everything is slipping out from under us all the time. It's the hardest thing. We want to cling to things, want them to stay the same, never to change. And things are changing all the time, and sometimes it's really difficult to accept. So taking refuge in our spiritual practice, in all those who have practiced this before us, and in the truth of things, the honesty, how things really are rather than how we want them to be, keeps us even, gives us some kind of peace, because we're not pretending. It's so easy to pretend, and there's so many social reasons to do that. So taking on a practice and taking refuge in this way means not pretending to ourselves. And if we don't pretend to ourselves, we become more honest with everybody else. We don't have to make a big deal about it. We don't have to go around telling everybody exactly what we think about everything and everybody. But just be self-honest. And that makes it safe for other people. And they feel they can be honest too. So he says, taking refuge is not only the ethical life, but respecting the laws of karma. So the laws of karma are simply the truth that everything happens for a reason, and that there's very little that we can do about our own particular karma, because there are so many causes and conditions that go into creating every moment of our life, much less our bones and blood, much less our history. If you try to track the karma of anything, what effect it's having, what effect it has, it's an action. Karma is about what acted itself, so that our actions have an effect on the next causes and conditions. We create causes and conditions simply by being alive and stirring the air, much less speaking and walking and all the things that we do. So it's a very awesome kind of idea. It's misunderstood by people, and back in the hippie days, they used to talk about my karma and your karma. Oh, my karma is blah, 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 and your karma, you've got cancer, so your karma is, and it's what you did and what your grandpa did and all those things. So it's not true. It's not true. We can't really know, except in a very blurry way, you could say. We can trace our ancestors as best we can and know, and we are affected by our ancestors. Everybody knows now it's in our DNA, at least for a couple of generations, what grandpa and grandma did. It's very interesting. So that's part of our karma. But there's a great deal more that we can't possibly know because we can't go any farther back. But part of Buddha's enlightenment experience was going all the way back to the lizards and the bugs. He remembered, quote unquote, his whole life experience on Earth as life began and began to build and change. So long before Darwin, he had this view, this long, long, long view of the starting up of human life, and that each one of us and our unborn bodies reflected this, so that when we were an unborn baby, we were first a little pig. You know, all the things that we might have been are still reflected in our life. That's very interesting, too. So that, too, is the interconnectedness of everything. So the important thing about this is that before I talk about that, it says, how does a Buddha come into being? That's very interesting for people, and we need to know. He says, how does a person become fully enlightened? He says, when we reflect on Buddhahood, we are bound to ask ourselves whether or not it's possible for an individual to attain such a state, to become a fully enlightened being, a Buddha. Here we find that the key lies in understanding the nature of Dharma, of truth. If the Dharma exists, then the Sangha will certainly exist. And the Sangha are those who are engaged in the path of the Dharma. They've realized and actualized its truth. So the possibility of attaining a freedom from negativity and afflictive emotions is total. That's what Buddhahood is just being in a state of not being thrown by things. the emotional and afflictive emotions and negativity. A friend of mine asked Suzuki Roshi once during a retreat, she said, "In me there's a yes and a no." And I think she was really wrestling with that, because in all of each of us there's a yes and a no. What do you do with it? And he looked at her for a long time and then he said, "Go with the yes." So we have to know that the no is there. If we don't accept and acknowledge the no in us, we can't accept the yes. Very important point. So he says, the Buddha's teaching and the spiritual realization based on our practice of that teaching has two aspects. One is the path that leads to the cessation of suffering and afflictive emotions. And we talk about the path. There really isn't a path. I mean, it's a metaphor for what's just under our feet and what our intention is. It's actually our intention that creates the path. It isn't out there anywhere, it's in here. And then the ending of it, the ending of suffering. So that sounds very difficult or impossible until we begin to practice and realize it's nothing to aim for, but that it actually informs us continually. So maybe I'll stop there. If there are questions, discussion. We didn't even do introductions around, and we have a new face tonight. Let's do that first.
Wendy, Marie,
Leslie,
Violet.
Yeah.
Jeffrey.
Lynn.
Ellen. Angie. How did you hear about us?
Yeah.
From Yop. Everybody's coming from Yop. That's great. That's super, yeah. Bring all these wonderful people.
I'm also currently studying Nichiren.
Nichiren, yeah. Yup, did too. Yeah?
I did too.
And you did too. Yeah. Anybody else? What's the chant? I've forgotten the chant.
Oh,
Nam-myoho-ryo. Oh, yeah. Over and over and over. Yeah. Another flavor of Buddhism. Same teaching. Basic teaching.
Might be a stupid question, but would it be possible to practice both Zen and Nichiren?
Well, I don't know Nichiren well enough to know. So I would say it's up to you. If you feel conflicted, you'd have to choose. But I know people practice Zen and Christianity. You know, there are monks and nuns who are practicing who are Christians. So it's certainly possible, but you'd have to try it. Yop knows. Is it possible?
For me, it was a switch, actually. At some point, I was just drawn more to the silence of Zen. And the specifics of the tradition are a little different. And so I was just more drawn to that. But whenever I meet friends who practice Nichiren, you know, we do that, we chant together. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's great. Yeah. Why not? Leslie?
So something you said today really surprised me. I guess rejected would be the word, the idea that everything happens for a reason. And my reason for that was that I had attached it to God, because the people I knew who believed that, it was God's reason.
Yes.
And so the way you explained it today really opened that idea up for me, so thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
To see, and also, I think it's in some way related to the idea of karma, that everything that's unfolding, having causes and conditions that are multiple, that's the reason. That's what I heard
yes.
you say was.
That's the reason.
That's the reason.
Yes.
Is how we are interconnected.
I see it sometimes. In physics, they show energy by arrows, and there's short arrows and long arrows depending on how powerful or how fast it's going or something. And I think that's what this is, what karma is all about. And that some of it is very small and simple, and some of it is mighty. And we get to experience in our own world, and each of us is a world. So each of us has a different experience, even the same things, because it keeps changing. But it's all connected. When?
So this brings up the question of free will.
There's so much talk about that now.
In philosophy
and psychology.
Okay.
There's a big debate about it. Do we have it or not? What do you think?
Yes, definitely.
I think it's one of those paradoxes that we do and we don't. And we don't know how to talk about it because it's so complicated. But you can't say that you do because all the causes and conditions are actually creating us all the time. And yet, we are making decisions constantly, and it's very important that we make good decisions as well. So it's both.
It's the mystery.
It's absolutely a mystery. It's the same as saying form doesn't differ from emptiness. We're somehow imbued with the whole of it, and we enact our life in small. So what we do is wake up to the whole situation as much as we can. That if we just stay small in our mind and think of ourselves as our individuality, that's imagining that there's free will, my will, but that's not quite the way it works. But there is some determination. We need to be very discriminating in our mind, and we need to make good choices, and we do. And that has big effect on everything else. But on the other hand, we are just a little tiny bug in this huge, immense dynamic that's so big we can't even imagine it, of which we are such a blip that we, I suppose eventually they will measure it, but it will be minuscule. But on the other hand, in some ways, if we devote our life to our spirituality, we become what it is that we are practicing, so that there is neither will nor not will. There is simply being where we are when we are, which is a bigger mystery than the other way of talking about it, of trying to carve it up and understand it as this way or that way. Really, in the end, there's just one way, and it's right here, right now. This way. And moment by moment, we live it. That's the most remarkable part of it. Ming?
Thank you. So at the end of meeting, we chant, "I vow to save all sentient beings."
Voila.
So my question is, how can we do that? Because I hesitate to say it. I don't think I can do it.
Yes. It's a very strange thing to say. It's translated in some places as "I vow to be with all things." Because saving sounds like we're putting ourselves on a high place and looking down on all those poor people down there. It's not like that. It's about being willing to be with whatever comes, simply to accept. So that if a little dog on the sidewalk comes up to you, you can either kick it or yell at it and make it go away, or you can stop and really encounter it in your own way. That's what saving a sentient being is. So it means all beings. It means the rocks. It means the grass and the stars. It means everything. It's a very excellent question, and everybody always asks that almost first thing, because it sounds so you wouldn't do that, right? But that isn't what it means, and we need a better translation.
So I was just wondering, what is holding sort of modern, like, American Zen from saying more directly what it means? Because I feel like with the history of religion in the West, it's something that for, like, younger people is actually a little bit touchy, you know, to put it like that.
Oh, yes.
Right. So that's my question.
Well, that's a very good point, in America especially, but everywhere actually, because we're voracious creatures and we do bad things. So we're not really saving all beings at all.
Right.
But it's important to try to a vow is to simply keep reminding ourselves to stay in the direction that we mean to be going in. So it can't be specific. And maybe we could just, we're still playing with the translations. And, you know, the more I read, the more I see that much of what we read and think is Dogen or all the things that are coming through Japan and China are, the translations aren't really correct. So I think we depend on this kind of material second. And first we depend on our own heart and mind. And let those be the first to help us. And then whoever can speak about it can be helpful too. But not to fall into loving the words, because words are cheap.
But if today it's just so easy for the cheap words to get all over the place.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, it is. It is. It just blasts out into the universe. And everybody knows or thinks they know. So that's why staying with the tradition is kind of important, even though you don't want to get stuck there. So it's tricky. In the Heart Sutra, as soon as Chikoji had its 501c3 and we were an actual place in the Zendo, I changed the translation of the Heart Sutra, feeling like I was being radical and terrible to do it, but I took out the he's, the he and the his. They didn't belong there. So, you know, the people who did translate it were guys, and probably who wrote it were guys. But it's a different time. And so we need to adjust and bring everybody in. So Kokno always said we should take all the material and write our own version. Because he came from Japan, he said, all I know is what I learned in Japan. And it's not completely relevant in America in the same way. So it's a great challenge for you who are young, especially. You could do it. Find new ways of expressing this mystery that could help people. I'm not asking you to do it, but
well, so one thing I think about is the way we end the Heart Sutra. It's by saying, this is the great transcendent mantra, the supreme mantra, and it like really like, you know, like rubs it in like that this is it. And I think I think that's really important because that's about Prajnaparamita, right?
Yes.
And the only thing is that given the history of what we are growing up in the West, it can be taken as this religion is the way and not others, or these traditions are the way and not others. And that's what I think relates to his question, saying, oh, but is it legal to practice both? You know?
There isn't a matter of legality about any of
right.
it. Everything is open.
Yeah.
Nothing is hidden.
Right.
So, but there is a tradition that goes back more than 2,000 years.
Right.
And for, I think what we have been doing, at least in America, is trying to see what it means, what comes to us, what they were trying to say, and then finding new ways of saying it. I feel like that's what I'm doing all the time. I'm just talking, you know, St. Louis, Missouri language, in the best way I can, about the Dharma. And as Buddha said, it's up to each person to test it in themselves and make sure that it makes sense, and don't take in and accept anything that does not make sense. If you don't like it, don't take it. Well, that's very important. Yeah?
So it almost sounds like it's open-ended and it's open for interpretation.
Yes.
And it's is Dharma like Taoism, the Tao, the way? Is it has it many similarities?
Well, that's how the Chinese coped with the Sanskrit that came to them. That was a familiar idea to them. They had words for the Tao. And so they in the beginning in China, they just made it sound like Taoism again in a new way. And then scholars began to study it and realize that no, it was not. It was based on meditation. So whatever words there are written about it or spoken about it, the basis of the whole of everything is meditation. That's why we do it, and that's why it's more important than any of the words that we speak about it. Because in meditation we become informed in a way that words can't do. The information you get in meditation is beyond words. It's really untalkaboutable. So all the words that are written are pointing to that experience. But none of them is it.
Sorry. So, I took this class on ancient Chinese philosophy, and it introduced Confucius, Mencius,
yes.
And Taoism, and they are known to be scholars who reflect their writing about compassion and benevolence and virtue on Buddhism. It's ingrained in Buddhism.
Yes. So is democracy. So it just keeps translating. Culture is different, so every culture has to accommodate new ideas in their way. So I think in the West we are taking to Buddhism because we've already understood about democracy, and that it has deep meaning for us if we really think about it. It means we're all connected. So yeah, there's some Taoism in Buddhism. You can track it. And there's Confucianism too. Respect for the community and the family, all of those things.
And Hinduism,
Buddha was a Hindu. So he never thought of himself as a Buddhist. He was just a Hindu with a little bit of a radical bent.
Discussion.
It's a little after 8. I did it again, didn't I? This is so fun. Well, we'll do some more. We'll do dependent origination.
Oh, no. Okay.
Next week. It's the best. It's the best. You will love it.
Announcement. We're not going to be here on the 4th of July.
Oh, right.
We're not going to try and meditate with all the firecrackers going off. So we'll send out an announcement to that effect. And does Marie have any announcements?
well, I sent out that email about the retreat beginning of August. Actually, there's 5 of us who are going, except you, it depends on your school schedule. And so there's a lot of people that are very new to the tradition. And so, you know, it would be nice to have people around who can tell people on how to sit or things like that. So everyone's welcome to join, of course.
Yeah, that'll be super.
That's in August?
Yes, beginning of August.
Mm-hmm.
And Angie is coming to teach on the Sunday, August 6th, on specifically the Eightfold Path within the Four Noble Truths.
So this is all just a build up to Yom Sashin.
Oh, kind of.
Get your tickets now.
Okay, 1 minute sit.
Okay, 1 minute sit.